I'm glad to be with you all here tonight. As you can see from the PowerPoint up here, me and David are continuing our study in the book of Psalms, moving on to Psalms chapter 14. Now, the chapter setting for Psalms 14, the chapter title tells us that it is a song of David, and we can see by the language in verse 7 that it seems to be looking towards a release from some sort of captivity. Psalms 14, verse 1 says, "Oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion when the Lord brings back the captivity of his people. Let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad." So as you can see there, like I said, it looks to be awaiting that deliverance from some captivity. It is possible that David could be speaking prophetically about the Babylonian captivity that was to come upon the children of Israel. But there is another option. The Bible sometimes uses the word or idea of captivity to show distress, such as in the story of Job. Job 42 and 10 says, "And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before." So if you're familiar with the story of Job, he never went into captivity himself, but he was in great distress. It could be just talking about one of the numerous things that happened to David or the children of Israel during David's time. This psalm is also very similar to Psalms 53. Now, Psalms 14, verse 1 says, "The fool has said in his heart, 'There is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good.'" So here from verse 1 of Psalms 14, we see that there's this fool. And these fools say that there is no God. If we look at Romans 28, we also see this idea. It says, "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting." So these people, these fools, they say there is no God. They don't like to think there is a God. They don't even like to entertain that thought. And the Bible calls them fools. Now verse 2, it says, "The fool has said in his heart, 'There is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. They have all turned aside. They have altogether become corrupt. There is none who does good. No, not one." So we see it says that these fools who don't believe there is a God, who don't entertain the thought of there being a God, it says they are corrupt, they have done abominable works, they have all turned aside. And it says there is none who does good. No, not one. Psalms 14:4, it says, "Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread, and do not call upon the Lord?" This goes back kind of to verse 1, where we see that they don't like to retain God in their knowledge. They say there isn't a God, and because of that, they don't call upon the Lord. These fools, that says they have no knowledge. They're ignorant. They don't believe there is a God. They don't like to even think about it. They're corrupt. They do things which aren't right, abominable works. Now, if you noticed in verse 4, it says, "who eat up my people." Now, at first you may read that and think of cannibalism, but that's not what this verse is referring to. If you look at Galatians 5 and 15, it says, "But if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another." So these people that we're talking about in Psalms 14, what they're doing is they don't care about other people. They will go through any means possible to get what they desire, even at the expense of others, even at the harm that comes to others. That's why it says, "who eat up my own people." In Galatians 5:15, talks about that more, like I said, consumed by one another. They don't care about anybody else around them. Their one goal is to please themselves and what they do. Whatever the cost may be to anybody else, it doesn't matter. As long as they're happy and they're pleased, that's all they care about. It also says that they have great fear. Psalms 14, and 5. It says, "There they are in great fear, for God is with the generation of the righteous." I also want to look at Proverbs 28 and 1. It says, "The wicked flee when no one pursues, but the righteous are bold as a lion." So, we've gone through and we've looked at these fools, it calls them. It says they have no knowledge, they're ignorant. It tells us they are corrupt, that they do abominable things. And we see here that they don't, that they have great fear and they flee when no one pursues. And that seems to be a strange thought to us, that they have nobody chasing them, no reason to fear, it would seem, and yet they flee. Now that concludes my portion of the study. I'm going to hand it off to David.
Carson left us with the question that here are these people that don't believe in God and they do whatever they want to do. They live immoral lives and yet they live in fear. They flee when no one pursues. How can that work? Proverbs 28 and 1 is about the natural paranoia that goes hand in hand with a guilty heart. Here's the thing about it. When somebody tells themselves, "Well, I don't have to answer to God. He's not there. I'm going to do what I want to do." Inside, they're still bruising their conscience. Because when Adam and Eve ate the fruit, that gave humans a conscience, a sense of right and wrong. And we have to do an awful lot of evil to blunt that conscience and make it not hurt when we do things that are wrong. And there are some people that do enough evil that they get to the point that, as the scriptures say, their conscience is seared with a hot iron. But in a lot of instances, you'll have somebody that will verbally insist, "Well, there's no God, I'm the master of my own destiny, I can do what I want." And they'll do iniquity, they'll be corrupt, and all these things that Carson showed us from early in the chapter, and still they'll live in fear and paranoia. That's where a lot of aberrant human behavior comes from in this modern era. Is people constantly wounding their conscience and the afflictions and the paranoia that goes hand in hand with that. That's where a lot of substance abuse comes from, believe it or not. I'm not saying it's the only reason ever for substance abuse, but that's where a lot of it comes from, is people trying to inebriate or intoxicate their minds to dull that conscience that says, "You're not doing what's right." That little voice inside that says, "This isn't right," and so they're screaming against it with anything they can get their hands on. There's kind of an interesting comparison in the first section of Psalms 14 and then the latter section of Psalms 14 and how that compares with Romans 1 and 28. A lot of these things Carson's already brought to our attention, or they've been in the verses that he's studied for us. The opening of the chapter calls them a fool. Later on, he just refers to them as someone without knowledge. Then he goes on and says, this fool says there's no God. And then later in the chapter, this person without knowledge doesn't call on God. Then he goes on to say, well, they're corrupt. And the other section says they live in great fear. That's the wounded conscience. Why? Because they're corrupt. They do abominable works, he said. Later in the chapter, he said they work iniquity. In Romans chapter 1, Paul wrote the saints at Rome about the same kind of mindset. He said these people don't want to retain God in their knowledge. That's like the person who said there's no God. And instead of living right, they have a corrupt or a reprobate mind. They've corrupted themselves. They work iniquity in the sense that they do things that are not fitting. So Romans 1 and 28 is a very kind of a capsulary review of Psalms 14 and the corrupted state of mind. Now understand this. In the context of 1000 BC, when David was living and writing the Psalms, that date of course is approximate, you've got two different kinds of people saying there is no God. One person says there's no God, and by that they mean they don't believe in the God of Israel. They believe in all these pagan gods of the Canaanites or the other nations that surrounded them. And the other one just doesn't believe in any God at all. When we think today of somebody that doesn't believe in God, we think of an outright atheist. But in ancient societies, somebody who didn't believe in the God or gods of that nation thought of them as an atheist. To the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, if you didn't believe in their panoply of all these different pagan deities, if you only believed in one God, they said you were an atheist because you didn't accept their idea of God. Well, it's kind of like that under the Mosaic faith. If you didn't accept the Mosaic idea of the true God of heaven, then to that degree you were denying the existence of God. So understand that a lot of pagans, in a sense, could be included in this because they didn't believe in the God of Israel, which is the true God of heaven. And therefore they said in their heart, there's no Elohim, there's no God. Elohim being the title of the God of Israel. They denied his existence. And so what did we find those nations doing? Not calling on God, living with corrupt minds and giving their hearts over to work iniquity. But the same is true of somebody who is not just an atheist in the ancient nationalistic sense that I described to you a moment ago, but somebody that's an atheist in the sense that they don't believe in any kind of God or any kind of creator at all. I was thinking about this coming into town for this evening service, and this is something I've thought about before, and it's just really became strong in my mind, and I want to share this with you. I want you to really think about this. If there is no God at all, there's nothing but matter. There's nothing but just physical matter. There's no mind or spirit that exists outside the realm of physical matter. That's what modern atheism insists on. Well, if that's true about God, then it's also true about you and about me. There is no spirit or mind that makes decisions of what you're going to do with your physical body. You're just a pile of matter that's following the laws of physics. It's expressed in all these complicated chemical equations and physical reactions that make us move this way and that, just like the wind moves this way and that. And the weather doesn't have a mind. There's no spirit there that's deciding, well, I'm going to rain today and be hot tomorrow. It's just matter that's obeying the laws of physics. And if there's no God or nothing else outside the physical realm but physical matter only, then that's all we are. We're all just a bunch of piles of matter rattling around here obeying the laws of physics. You're not deciding to do good or do evil. What you do isn't good or evil any more than it's good or evil for a rock to succumb to gravity and tumble down the side of a mountain. It's just a pile of matter obeying the laws of physics. And so you've got someone that's reached that conclusion. Now, there's some atheists that will readily admit, yes, this is what we believe. And there are others who would say, no, we believe that matter has, through the formation of life, become sentient and independent and able to make its own decisions. And I would just reply, well, then can that matter decide to violate the laws of physics? Well, no, we can't do that. Anybody would say that. Well, then, all right, that's just matter that's obeying the laws of physics. And it can't decide anything to the contrary of what it's doing. So somebody has said, I'm going to believe in a system that says I can't make decisions, that I'm just a pile of matter, so that I get to make my own decisions. That's why it's folly to say that there's no creator whatsoever. And that's the state of heart that doesn't want to retain God in their knowledge. Now, just that one simple observation makes it really, really evident that it's really silly to not believe in some kind of designer or creator. Whether you believe in the God of the Bible or another kind of God, it's silly to not believe in some kind of creator for the reason that I just described. So let's talk about how someone would come to this conclusion of not believing in God or not want to retain God in their knowledge. Let's look at the answer to this problem. Proverbs 1 and 7 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." The foolish heart that says there's no God, that doesn't believe in the true God of heaven, that foolish heart doesn't want wisdom or instruction. That foolish heart doesn't want to be told what to do. And that's why they reject God. Because God isn't there to just make us and say, okay, go do what you want. But he makes us and holds us accountable for the things that we do. And that state of heart despises being told what to do. And if you're going to fix that, the fix is to accept we are God's creatures and he has the right to govern us. That is the beginning of fearing God. And that is the beginning of wisdom that lets you step out of this cycle of folly. The moment we embrace that a creator has the right to rule his creation, everything else begins to fall in line. And that is the answer. There lingers this question in man's mind that sets on the balance seeking evidence. A lot can be said about evidence for or against the existence of God. And if you read after some of the atheists, you'll certainly read different kinds of evidence that they believe speaks to their point of view. But I went to high school with a guy that back then he was an atheist. I think he's changed his mind since then, but back then, he was an atheist, and one day he came to school very excited. I probably have told you this story before. He came to school very excited. He said, "David, I can prove without a doubt that the Bible is wrong and it contradicts itself." And I said, "Okay, let's have it." And he says, "The Bible says on Judgment Day that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess. And I won't bow to him when that day comes." Well, it just hit me. He believes that day is coming. He just doesn't want to do what he's told. He just doesn't want to submit. And that we talked about that for a moment and then moved on to something else because his mind was made up and it had nothing to do with any evidence for or against evolution, for or against the existence of God, anything he could read in the science book. In spite of all that stuff he wanted to talk about, what it was really about was he didn't want to be told what to do. He didn't want to have to submit to a creator. So I'll just imagine that he's not there. So on the one hand, you've got this evidence that says, you know what, there's a God. And I just gave a small sampling of it in a philosophical sense. There's a lot of things we could talk about that's beyond the scope of this study. What gets in the way of accepting that when you look around, it's obvious that there's a designer behind all of this? That just seems evident. That if you see something that's built and designed, you know, we use things like watches to illustrate this. You just look at that and say, well, there has to be a watchmaker because it's so intricately designed and it works so well together. What gets in the way of people accepting that? And the answer to that is the desire for sin. Philippians 3, verse 18 and 19, "For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, and whose glory is their shame, who set their mind on earthly things." Now these people are said to have their belly as their God. That word belly there just stands for the physical appetites, the appetites of the flesh. And giving in to those appetites, they tend to earthly things. So these people have a God. It's not the God of heaven. The God is their own base human desires and impulses. Their God is their appetite, their desire for sin. And because they've chosen that God, they're going to reject the God of heaven that gets in the way of all that. And that desire for sin, that desire to do what I want to do, comes in their mind to outweigh any other kind of evidence. Any other kind of evidence isn't even up for consideration. It doesn't matter how compelling it is because I want to do what I want to do. And so therefore, there's no God there to tell me I can't do that. So we have to listen to wisdom. We have to accept the guidance of telling us what's right and what's wrong. Proverbs 1, verse 20 through 33. "Wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open squares. She cries out in chief concourses. At the openings of the gates in the city, she speaks her words. How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. Turn at my rebuke. Surely I will pour out my spirit on you. I will make my words known to you. Because I have called and you refused. I have stretched out my hand and no one regarded. Because you disdained all my counsel and would have none of my rebuke. I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your terror comes. When your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind. When distresses and anguish come upon you, then they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me, because they hated knowledge and they did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would have none of my counsel and despised my every rebuke. Therefore they shall eat of the fruit of their own way and be filled to the full with their own fancies. For the turning away of the simple will slay them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. And whoever listens to me will dwell safely and will be secure without fear of evil. That frames the problem of the hour. You have this person that rejects God's counsel. They don't want to hear it. And so they put him out of their mind. And what happens? The time will come that person will be in trouble. And if it doesn't come before then, that day will be judgment day. And that person will then want God. Then we'll know how much we need God. And God said, then I'm not going to answer. God won't be there. You see, we have to accept him now in his governance of our fleshly appetites. And if we're not going to accept him now, we can't have him then. And so the answer is to listen to wisdom and accept the reality. We know there's a right and a wrong. Even atheists will insist, well, you can be an atheist and do good. If there's no God, there's no such thing as good. There is no moral arbitration or defining standard that says this is right and this is wrong. It's just whatever the laws of physics tell you to do, that's what you do. You're just obeying the laws of physics. But when we acknowledge there's a right and a wrong, that opens our minds up to the idea of accepting the wisdom of God that pertains to right and wrong and governs human conduct. And then from there we go into accepting that knowledge, listening to God, and becoming secure in our relationship with Him. And Psalms takes that up in Psalms 14 and 6 when he said, "You shame the counsel of the poor, but the Lord is his refuge." This person that's the victim of the one who denies God, that person is a faithful believer because they've gone to God for their refuge. They've embraced God's right to govern our conduct. And so they have no problem accepting that he's there and submitting to him. In Hebrews 6, verse 17 and 18, he talks about the Lord being our refuge when he says, "Thus God, determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath that by two immutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, that we might have strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us." He paints a vivid picture here of the faithful fleeing life's folly, life's problems, life's perils, and running to God for refuge. So you see, our embracing of the governance of God opens us up to receive his aid. That's the thing about it. It's not just about being willing to submit to him doing what, you know, him telling us what to do and us doing what we're told. It goes beyond that. It adds to it the benefit and the blessing of his help. In the hour of death, and that we have hope of the resurrection from the dead, and on the final judgment day, wherein we can have acquittal from our sin through the blood of Jesus Christ. So we flee to him for refuge. While the others may afflict other people, we turn to God for relief. Let's talk about that bringing back the captivity that Carson mentioned earlier. That's Psalms 14 and 7. Oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion when the Lord brings back the captivity of his people. Let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. Psalms 126, the first three verses, talks about this kind of idea when it says, when the Lord brought back the captivity of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. Then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are glad. When the Lord restores his people from whatever calamity they may be suffering, and for you and I, that's on the judgment day, when he restores us, laughter will fill our mouths, songs will fill our tongues, and others who didn't want to retain God in their knowledge, who didn't want God, who didn't think they needed God, now in their hour of need for God will look and know that we've been blessed, that God has done great things for us. And the faithful will be glad. The faithful will rejoice. Psalms 14 is really valuable insight into human nature. The desires of the flesh get in the way of our judgment. It impedes our ability to reason to the obvious conclusion. There's got to be some kind of creator behind this. Let's see if he's reached out to us to find us. And for the Christian, we understand there is a creator and he has reached out to us in the person and work of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And for all the different reasons that I believe in him with full confidence, perhaps the chiefest among them is that empty tomb. His resurrection from the dead. I believe the most proven fact from ancient history. I don't doubt it at all. Scoffers can scoff all they want, but one thing they'll never do is answer the evidence. Because their mind isn't on the evidence. Their mind is on the desires of the flesh. We don't just serve a God who has rules. We serve a God who has a Son who is our risen Savior. And he can be your Savior. If you'll accept his right to make the rules and submit to him. If we can assist you in that process of acceptance this evening, we want to do that. If you're not a Christian, we'd like to help you to become a Christian. If you are a Christian, you need the church to pray for you regarding these things. Of course, we would like to assist you with our prayers. If we can help you in either way, please come. Have a seat on the front while we stand and while we sing.